From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology.
Today, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame begins a week-long tribute to the late singer Sam Cooke. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about Cooke's music, his life, and his murder with Peter Guralnick. Guralnick's new biography of Cooke is called Dream Boogie. Sam Cooke started as a gospel singer, then went on to record such hits as You Send Me, Chain Gang, and Wonderful World. Also, critic-at-large John Powers considers what the new film Good Night and Good Luck has to tell us about the conflicts between news and entertainment. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
Don't know what a slide room is for, but I do know what it one is two. And if this one could be with you, what a wonderful world this would be.
First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame begins a week-long tribute to Sam Cooke, a great singer who was also significant for producing his own records and starting his own record label long before this was common. My guest, Peter Guralnick, has written a new biography of the late singer called Dream Boogie. Guralnick is best known for his two-part biography of Elvis Presley and has written extensively on soul, blues, and country music. Sam Cooke is best known for his hits from the 50s and 60s, like You Send Me, Wonderful World, and Chain Gang. But before he sang soul music, he sang gospel. When he crossed over, his success encouraged other gospel singers to try secular music. One of them was Aretha Franklin. This is what she told me in 1999.
As time went on, and I just began to listen to more and more of his recordings, and I loved them the way they were produced, the melodies, the background singers. I was interested in changing fields as well, but I was not as confident, I guess, as Sam was to begin with. And finally I said, well, if Sam made it, maybe I could too.
Well, let's hear how Sam Cooke sounded before recording secular music. Here he is with the Soul Stirrers in 1954.
One of these mornings I'm going away. Any day now I'm going to heaven to stay. Maybe morning, night or noon, but I'm going to see the Father and by his side. No sadness, just only complete gladness. But any day I know that I am a going.
You can hear how Sam Cooke's gospel style translated into soul music when you listen to You Send Me, his first hit, which climbed all the way to number one in 1957.
Darling, you send me, I know you send me. Darling, you send me, honest you do, honest you do, honest you do. Lasted so long. Now I find myself wanting to marry you and take you home. Whoa, whoa.
Peter Guralnick, welcome back to Fresh Air. This is the song that Sam Cooke crossed over with from gospel to pop. What did it mean to Cooke to cross over and to have, you know, a number one song on the pop charts?
It meant tremendous fear and tremendous relief. I mean, the greatest barrier to Sam Cooke crossing over was not so much a religious concern. He never left the church. He never left gospel music. He continued to sing gospel music until the day he died and to write gospel songs. So it really wasn't a matter of challenging his faith. And he had been brought up by his father to look for the opportunity. I mean, his father was a member of a striving generation, part of the Great Migration to Chicago, and someone who really taught his children to get ahead, that you didn't, whether you made your living by singing or shining shoes, that had nothing to do with your dedication to God. Sam's father, incidentally, was a minister, the Reverend Charles Cook, in the Church of Christ Holiness. But for Sam, the great fear was that he wouldn't succeed. He knew what he had in gospel music. He had come up against an economic wall. He had come up against a wall in terms of the success that he could see for himself, and he didn't want to stop with that wall. He, from Sam's point of view, there was no end to his ambition. But at the same time, there was that kind of fear that any of us might feel, that what if I do this and I don't succeed? And the great fear was that if he didn't succeed, if he failed in pop music, that he would never be able to go back to gospel. He would never be accepted again.
How did You Send Me become that first song? I know he'd recorded another secular song on a small label, but this was the song that really crossed over. It's an original of his. Is there a story behind the song?
There are a lot of stories behind the song, but the story behind its success, or how it got chosen, was that Sam had actually made a number of attempts in the 9 or 10 months prior to his recording session in the spring of 57, in June 1st of 57, at which he recorded You Send Me. Now, he had been writing songs for a good while. He'd been writing songs all through 1956, not at first with the idea of recording them himself. And then when he made the decision to leave the Soul Stirrers, he put a number of those songs and a couple of other songs down on tape, sent them out to his producer, Bumps Blackwell, in California, with just him playing guitar. And among those songs was You Send Me. When they went into the studio, they recorded You Send Me in Summertime as the potential single. And it was Summertime. It was Sam's arrangement of George Gershwin's Summertime that both Sam and Bumps Blackwell believed was the A side of the song. You Send Me was a very peculiar hybrid. And it was a song that when Sam first sang it for his guitarist, Cliff White, the guitarist who played on the You Send Me session and then continued with Sam up until his death, when Sam first played it for Cliff, Cliff said, "I thought the guy was joking. He just kept singing the same words over and over and over again. I thought he'd lost his mind or something." And when it finally came to the release, Cliff said he breathed a sigh of relief. He said, "Well, he finally got out of that, that repeated phrase." But again, Sam had a very strongly developed aesthetic, and one element of it was simplicity. And he believed that every song ought to be accessible, that it ought to be something, the melody ought to be something that the man on the street could hum, and the lyrics should be something that were written in plain enough language so everybody could pick up on them, and that they would tell a story plainly and directly. So when the single came out, You Send Me and Summertime, Sam and Bumps went out on the road still with the idea that Summertime would be the hit. And they went around to visit DJs. This was on a promotional tour, not a performance tour. And virtually every DJ said, turned the record over and said, "This is the hit. You Send Me is the hit."
My guest is Peter Guralnick, and he's written a new biography of Sam Cooke. It's called Dream Boogie, and Peter's also the author of a 2-volume biography of Elvis Presley. Peter, how do you think Sam Cooke's gospel singing compared to his pop singing?
I think it compared, in some ways it compared very directly, in other ways it contrasted. I think the comparison is that Sam learned, he was inclined very early on, and he learned very early on that his strength, his mark, was really in lowering the volume. The first show that he did, or the first program he did with the Soul Stirrers in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, when he was just 19 years old, he was blown off the stage by the Pilgrim Travelers and the Five Blind Boys, by their showmanship, by the way in which Archie Brownlee and the two leads for the Pilgrim Travelers just shouted, and he attempted to do that and failed. And both S.R. Crane, the Soul Stirrers manager, and J.W. Alexander, who was the manager for the Pilgrim Travelers and a kind of mentor to Sam from an early age, and who became his was his friend and became his business partner several years later. Both Crane and J.W. Alexander counseled Sam, rely on your strengths. Your strength is in the way in which you, the unique way in which you sang, in which you sing, the unique way in which you can draw the listener to you. You can draw the congregation to you. And that was the basis for Sam's gospel style, was this kind of crooning style. It was a seductive style. That was what he brought to pop music. That's what I think is so extraordinary about his transition to pop music, and it was what both Bumps Blackwell, his producer, and what J.W. Alexander, and what this DJ in Newark who managed Roy Hamilton, Bill Cook, all saw in him. They saw the potential for a teenage singing idol. J.W. Alexander felt that Sam was the first black performer, rhythm and blues performer, who had the potential to really be a matinee idol for teenagers, black and white, and for whom the category didn't have to exist. This depended to some extent on Sam's looks, because he was an extraordinarily good-looking man. But it also depended on the manner of his singing, which was not challenging, was not threatening, and didn't require a tremendous adjustment on the part of a white audience to what he was presenting.
My guest is Peter Guralnick. His new biography of Sam Cooke is called Dream Boogie. We'll talk more about Sam Cooke after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest Peter Guralnick has written a new biography of Sam Cooke called Dream Boogie. Before we get back to the interview, let's hear Cooke's 1962 hit, Having a Party.
We're having a party, dancing to the music played by the DJ on the radio. The cokes are in the icebox, popcorn's on the table. Me and my baby, we're out here on the floor. So Mr. DJ, keep those records playing, 'cause I'm having such a good time dancing with my baby.
One of the paradoxes in Sam Cooke's life is that, you know, he comes out of the gospel circuit. He's singing, you know, he's singing sanctified songs. And then, I mean, he becomes a kind of a drinker, a gambler, lots of women in his life. How did he reconcile this kind of contradiction?
Probably the same way that almost every other gospel singer and many ministers do. He wasn't really a gambler. He was a bad gambler.
Okay.
He gave the money back if he ever won, and he didn't win much of the time. The drinking, I think, was something that as a kid he probably didn't do all that much and became much more pronounced after the death of the drowning of his son Vincent at 18 months in the spring of 1963. But the women, Sam always had a very active social life from the time he was quite young. And I would say the women were always a part of that life. And I think if you examined, I think it's just it's the range of human activity. I don't think you'll find any less sexual activity in the church in general than you will in the world at large, and certainly not within the gospel world. So I think that without sin there'd be no salvation, and I think that there was always hope of salvation.
Did it bother him that he was a sinner? Did he think of himself as a sinner?
You know, I doubt that. I would say Sam had a more analytic approach to life. I don't think he was satisfied with easy solutions I don't think he would categorize himself in that way. I think he would perhaps take a broader view that all of us are sinners in different ways. And I would imagine the thing that would have bothered him most of all, although I certainly don't have any evidence of this, was the difficulty that he had in expressing emotion outside of his music, the difficulty he had in a sense in owning up to the way that he felt, to the conflicted feelings that he might feel, not sinning feelings, but just because he was so charming, he was so charismatic, and he felt the burden, I think, of carrying that image with him everywhere he went, not simply for the general public, but even with the other performers that he traveled with. And I think the burden of keeping his feelings inside is something that many of those closest to him remarked upon. I mean, that was what was most extraordinary about researching this book, or meeting all the people who were closest to Sam. Bobby Womack, who was Sam's protege, who was just an 18 or 19-year-old when he started playing with Sam, said that Sam told him if he felt bad, he just didn't go out of his room because he didn't want to put that burden on anybody.
Another way in which Sam Cooke was groundbreaking is that he co-founded and co-owned a record label, that he started with his friend and business partner, J.W. Alexander. Why did he want that?
It really stemmed from an innate sense of black pride and self-determination, which was something. He was a student of black history at a time when the term didn't exist. He was someone who had been brought up by his father to believe that you should respect yourself most of all. Never allow anyone to disrespect you, but respect yourself most of all. He realized very early on the same thing that many performers, both black and white, recognized, which is that he did not own the fruits of his own labor, that other people were making money off of his creative endeavor, and that, in fact, particularly with respect to songwriting, that this was really where the money was and where the money still is today in the music business, is both in writing and publishing songs. And when he switched over, from Specialty Records to Keen Records with his first pop record under his own name, You Send Me, Bumps Blackwell, who was managing him and producing him at that time, told him, Sam, when you go over to Keen Records, you're going to own your own publishing. And that means we're going to make a lot more money. Well, it didn't happen. Bumps was going on a nod and a wink, or perhaps just on wishful thinking. And eventually, J.W. Alexander, who had set up his own publishing company in the summer of 1958, and kept bugging Sam, like, come on, you've got to have your own publishing. They're never going to pay you if you don't have your own publishing. J.W. Alexander won Sam over. And at the beginning of 1959, he went into partnership with J.W. in this publishing company. And that was really the genesis of a creative rebirth on his part. He started writing songs like crazy in the early part of 1959, just writing one song after another, essentially to demo them for other singers, and with the idea that they would be recorded by other singers. And the outgrowth of that, some 9 months later, was the startup of a record company, SAR Records, S-A-R, which J.W., Sam, and S.R. Crane at the beginning formed specifically to record the Soul Stirrers, who had been cut loose from their recording contract at that time, but ultimately to record, as J.W. said, people they liked both in terms of their music, people they liked personally, and essentially to give expression, untrammeled expression, to an artistic vision that Sam and J.W. to a lesser extent both had.
So was Sam Cooke recording for RCA at the same time that he had his own record label?
Yeah, no, he was. Sam Cooke, I think, very wisely determined that he needed a record company with greater capital or capitalization than his own record company could give him. He needed the promotion that a a full-scale record company could give him. So he started recording for RCA in January of 1960, and that was almost precisely the time that he started recording new artists other than the Soul Stirrers for his own Sire Records. And virtually every session was produced by Sam Cooke, and you can hear Sam producing these sessions you can hear him teaching the song to different artists, the songs to different artists on the album, the Sire Record Story, on the two CD set, the Sire Record Story.
Peter Guralnick is the author of a new biography of Sam Cooke called Dream Boogie. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's Sam Cooke with the Soul Stirrers, rehearsing for a session on his record label. He's explaining the meaning of the lyric to the song Lead Me to Calvary.
All right, Jim, I'm back on you now. I want you in hell. I'm going to holler at you.
Gethsemane.
Gethsemane. Oh, yes, I forget thine agony. Thine shall the glory.
Thine shall thy glory be.
Lest
I forget.
Lest
the glory be.
Thine glory be.
Thine shall thy glory be. No, thine shall the thine. Glory be.
That's right.
Thine shall the glory be. Can't be thine shall thy glory be.
Yeah, I shall be thy glory.
No, no.
Okay.
Thine.
Okay.
Wait a minute. No,
yeah,
let me understand
that. Get the sense of it now.
Thine means yours.
Uh-huh.
Yours shall the glory be. The glory ain't mine. It belongs to you.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Thine shall the glory be. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
It means the glory belong to you. It don't belong to me.
Thine shall thy. Thine shall. The
glory.
Okay.
Yeah. It means I'm giving all the glory to you.
Yeah.
I'm giving all
that's
the glory
good.
To you. I don't want none.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And we in business.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, featuring Secrets of the Widow's Son by David Shugarts, a look at the upcoming sequel to The Da Vinci Code. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Books, publisher of No True Glory, a frontline account of the battle for Fallujah by Bing West, co-author of The March Up. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on Sam Cooke. Also, critic at large John Powers considers the new film Good Night and Good Luck.
If you ever change your mind.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Peter Guralnick. He's written a new biography of Sam Cooke called Dream Boogie. Cooke's hits from the 50s and 60s include You Send Me, Only 16, Wonderful World, Chain Gang, Twistin' the Night Away, and Another Saturday Night. To understand what a great singer he was, you need to also hear his early gospel records and some of his lesser-known soul recordings, like this one, which has just been reissued. Here's Lost and Lookin' from Cooke's 1963 album, Nightbeat.
I'm lost and a looking for my baby. Wonder why my baby can't be found. I'm lost
and a looking for my baby. Lord knows my baby ain't around, so I'm lost and a looking for my baby. Wonder why my baby can't be found, lost and a searching for my baby. Lord knows my baby ain't around, crying for my baby, crying all alone, calling for you, come home, come home. I'm lost and a calling for my baby. Baby, won't you please come home? I'm lost and a calling for my baby. I need you 'cause I'm so alone.
Sam Cooke, recorded in 1963. Let's get back to our interview with Peter Guralnick. It was in 1964 that Sam Cooke was shot to death in just an incredibly pointless, tragic shooting. And I'm sure you've done a lot of research about how this happened, because there's always been a lot of questions surrounding what really happened. So could we just, like, reconstruct a little bit what happened that night? He went to a cheap hotel with another woman. Who was the woman?
The woman was a prostitute named Elisa Boyer, whom he met earlier in the evening at a restaurant in Hollywood. And she was a very attractive. She was referred to in the press, in the black press anyways, Eurasian, and a very attractive young woman. And it wasn't, this was not out of character for Sam. He actually had, was committed to the idea. He told Bobby Womack, get yourself a high hooker. Just don't mess with your fans, because over the years, his involvement with his fans had caused him a lot of trouble, caused them a lot of trouble, and caused him, in his view, a lot of money. So from his point of view, it was far more practical to go with a prostitute. And this was something, oddly enough, that his wife Barbara also endorsed. So I think the greatest, he went to the motel with this woman. She, according to the private investigator's report, her modus operandi was not altogether straightforward. She got her client to go into the bathroom to take a shower, clean himself up, and while he was in the bathroom, she would make off with his clothes, his wallet, his credit cards, and everything else. And I think the assumption was that the client was either drunk enough or would be embarrassed enough not to pursue her. Well, Sam was neither, as it turned out, and ran out of the ran after her, believed that she had gone into the motel manager's apartment office when she saw him after her, banged on the door, eventually broke the door down, and whether Elisa Boyer was there or not, I mean, according to the court testimony, she wasn't, but whether or not she was, Sam did not believe that she was not there, and was threatening enough so that the motel manager, Bertha Franklin, pulled out a gun and shot him.
And when he burst into her office, it sounds like he was wearing his jacket and his shoes, which were the clothes that were left behind.
Yeah, he seems to have had one shoe on, although I can't quite picture that, but yeah, he had a jacket and a shoe on. And
that was probably all he was wearing.
Yeah, no, exactly. So, I mean, this was not the kind of thing that would inspire confidence on the part of anyone that they were dealing with a reasonable person.
And the motel manager probably didn't know who he was.
I tend to think she did know who he was. She said in her testimony she didn't, but I find that difficult to believe. But whether she did or she didn't, it made him no less threatening. It's, you know, a terrible end to a noble life. And what I think is more significant, though, than his death. And to some extent, you can see this as part of a piece. It was in Sam's character never to back down when he felt he was being taken advantage of. It was what his father had taught him, and it shows up all through his life. And, I mean, if you think about it, the previous year, he had come to Shreveport, arrived at the new Holiday Inn in town, which had a policy, supposedly, despite the rigid segregation in the South, Holiday Inns across the country said they had adopted an integrated policy. When Sam showed up, the manager said, no, we don't have a reservation for you. In that situation, Sam became so enraged and started yelling and swearing at the manager of the motel and against the entreaties of his brother Charles, his road manager S.R. Crane, who had been with the Solsters, and his wife Barbara. He would not be pulled away. And his wife kept saying to him, Sam, they're going to kill you. And Sam just said, they're not going to kill me. I'm Sam Cook. And Barbara said, to them, you're just another N-word. But in that, let's say Sam had gotten killed in that situation, it would have been for much the same reason, because he couldn't back down. And it would be an entirely different story, obviously. I mean, this would be, he would be martyred, in a sense, to the forces of prejudice, to the forces of segregation. But essentially, it would have been for the same reason. And it's a peculiar thing. I think that, the most significant aspect of it is that the black community to this day simply cannot accept. He was such a shining light. He was such a shining star. He represented such nobility, something way beyond the ordinary singer or entertainer, that at the time, I don't think there was virtually no one in the black community who didn't believe that somehow or other this was a conspiracy, a racist conspiracy to kill Sam Cooke. And to this day, I could have had a 50-page appendix in the book with all the conspiracy theories, every one of them different, every one of them different in its details and different in its narrative, but essentially all proving that this is what happens when a proud black man becomes too big for his britches. And I think as a metaphor, both for that time and to some extent for this, it's absolutely true. But in terms of what happened, there's no evidence to support it. And what's most significant is that the people who knew Sam best, for the most part, believed that this is what happened, that the story was largely as it was told in court, and that Sam's behavior and his presence at the motel were simply not uncharacteristic of the Sam Cooke that they knew.
You mentioned that there's a lot of conspiracy theories about what really happened to Sam Cooke the night he was killed. You say in your book that a lot of Sam Cooke's family blamed his wife Barbara for his death. In what way did they hold her responsible?
Well, Barbara Cooke and Barbara Campbell Cook and the Cook family. The Cook family never approved of Barbara Campbell, who met Sam when she was barely 13 years old and Sam was about 17, fell in love with him. It was love at first sight, but it was, and it may have been love till the end of their lives. I mean, I don't doubt the attachment, but it was not a storybook tale. But the Cook family never believed that Barbara was good enough for Sam. They felt that she was an adventuress, and whether she was too young at the time she met him, they simply didn't approve of her in any way. And when Sam married her, when their daughter was 6 years old, this was not something which made them any happier. Ultimately, by Barbara's own account, she and Sam were essentially each pursuing separate lives at the time of Sam's death. And Barbara was going out with a bartender named Al Woods at the time, and Sam had his own dates. So from the Cook family's point of view, I think they saw Barbara as neglecting Sam. If he were happy at home, why would he be roaming around? But I think this is a, you know, we're all protective of our families, of our children, and I think that this is not an this is not it's totally understandable what they felt, and I'm not arguing with their emotional reaction or with Barbara's emotional feelings either, but I think there's no objective evidence of anything other than that they felt that she wasn't the right person for Sam.
You interviewed many people for this book, including Sam Cooke's widow, Barbara, who hadn't spoken publicly before about Cooke. Why did she talk with you?
That I can't say. You'd have to ask Barbara. I mean, it was a remarkable. We spent 4 or 5 days, two sessions a day, and it was just, it was very intense and very detailed. But I can't say why she did. I certainly had been seeking this interview for 5 or 6 years at the time, but why she finally consented to do it, I can't say.
My guest is Peter Guralnick. His new biography of Sam Cooke is called Dream Boogie. He'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Peter Guralnick. We're talking about his biography of Sam Cooke, which is called Dream Boogie. One of Sam Cooke's greatest records was released on an album very late in his life, and it was released posthumously as a single. And the song is A Change Is Gonna Come. This is a song that he wrote. And before we actually hear it, what inspired this song, and what was the change of direction it represented in his music?
What inspired the song, A Change Is Gonna Come, was really everything that was going on in this country, in Sam's consciousness at that time with respect to the racial situation, with respect to the civil rights movement, with respect to the sit-ins. Specifically, Sam was inspired. He was on tour in North Carolina in the spring of 1963, and he and J.W. Alexander spoke with the student sit-ins and spoke quite extensively, and that was something which was very memorable for him. Within a couple of months of that, J.W. Alexander gave him the Bob Dylan album that had Blowing in the Wind on it, and Sam responded extremely, very directly to that song, and told J.W. what a great song it was, but it should have been written by a black man. It shouldn't, you know, it wasn't that he was very admiring of Bob Dylan, as he was of the Rolling Stones, of the Animals. I mean, his ears were wide open, and he heard new sounds, and he talked to Bobby Womack quite a bit about the way in which someone like Dylan put a song across. Bobby Womack said, "That's terrible. That guy can't sing." And Bobby said, "Listen to the words. Listen to the way he puts the songs across. Listen to the credibility he has. Listen to the way in which an audience will respond to it." He said, "That's the future." In any case, Sam, Blowing in the Wind was unquestionably influential. I think there's no doubt that the Birmingham demonstrations, and then the in the spring of '63, and then the March on Washington, meant an enormous amount to him. And right in the wake of that, Sam had his own. He had many moments. You couldn't escape the moments all through your through. No African American could escape an awareness of the racial situation every minute of every day. But Sam's experience in Shreveport, when he got turned away from the motel and refused to back down, was an enormously traumatic event, just as it had been in 1949 when in Memphis he got picked up by the police for going into a whites-only park, and he got cuffed around by them and spoke of it to the end of his life. So that humiliation, that indignation, he wrote A Change Is Gonna Come, I would say, within a month or so. What scared Sam the most about the song was that it came to him almost unannounced. It came to him in a dream. And this is what he told everybody. He played the song for his wife Barbara, for J.W. Alexander, for Bobby Womack, for Leroy Krum from the Soul Stirrers, and told them all essentially the same thing, which was that the song had just come to him. It had come to him unannounced. Unlike other songs which he worked on, this song simply presented itself in its complete form, and it scared him. He didn't know where it was coming from, and he and Bobby Womack talked about it, and his feeling was it felt like death. And I can't really interpret what that means. I mean, I don't know whether it was the sense that he was not in control of what he was saying. It's a beautifully written, it's a beautifully crafted song, both the melody and the lyrics. And it's typical of Sam in the sense that rather than being yoked to a specific event, it starts from a generality, from a saying that can apply, a change is going to come, that can apply to almost anything. And it's the reason, I think, that the song has continued to have currency all these years.
Do you think that if Sam Cooke had lived, that A Change Is Gonna Come would have been the start of a new direction for him, a new, more socially engaged type of song?
You know, I think the thing about Sam is that you need a new word. I mean, you think about the bifurcated personality. Well, with Sam, you need a multiple of bi that would represent 20. He really intended to go in every direction at once, and I think one of those directions would have been, you know, a more socially conscious one. And the fact that in that same year, in 1964, he started the first of what were intended to be a series of soul stations. He called the Soul Station Number One, which were kind of neighborhood storefront locations, which would offer talented but sort of disaffected black youth the opportunity to come in, to try out, to rehearse, along with the idea of doing some things that were more socially conscious. He had committed to doing a concert, civil rights, a concert for Dr. Martin Luther King. But at the same time, he also intended, he had just signed a movie contract, he intended to go to Las Vegas. All of these things, in a sense, for most people, would cancel each other out. And you would tend to think, well, if he goes in that direction, he can't possibly go in this other direction. That means he won't do this thing. But in Sam's mind, I think he believed he could do it all. He could appeal to everyone across the board. And he was not inclined to limit himself in any way. But what it would have meant in practical terms, would the Las Vegas, the sort of the glitz, the Sammy Davis Jr. approach, would that have canceled out the direction he was going with A Change Is Going to Come, or even with a song like Keep Moving On? I think there's no way of telling. At the end of his life, he literally was moving in about 7 or 8 different directions.
Well, let's hear Sam Cooke's recording, A Change Is Going to Come. Peter Goralnik, thank you so much for talking with us about Sam Cooke.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Sam Cooke, Peter Guralnick's new biography of Cook is called Dream Boogie. Coming up, critic-at-large John Powers has some thoughts about the new movie Good Night and Good Luck and the world of infotainment. This is Fresh Air. Now that George Clooney's movie Good Night and Good Luck has been out for a few weeks, our critic-at-large John Powers has some thoughts about the impact of the film, about Edward R. Murrow, CBS, and McCarthyism.
When you live in a politically polarized era, as we do today, too much of the culture is seen through the prism of the immediate historical moment. Last year, for example, Philip Roth's novel The Plot Against America was widely viewed as an oblique commentary on America's right-wing drift. It was that. But it was also something much more. Roth working through fears, childhood memories, and his own tricky relationship to his Jewishness. Now comes Good Night and Good Luck, George Clooney's film about the CBS newsman Edward R. Murrow's celebrated battle with Senator Joseph McCarthy. The movie is being treated as a liberal feel-good picture, offering an historical analogy between the Red Scare and what Clooney sees as the climate of fear created by the Bush administration. But while Clooney is an unabashed liberal, only an idiot would think that we're in a new blacklist era. Heck, Sean Penn won an Oscar. Or that condemning McCarthyism is a uniquely liberal position. On the contrary, when Ann Coulter wrote a book defending tail gunner Joe McCarthy, she was whacked by the likes of Bill O'Reilly and the Wall Street Journal. Judging from the response, Good Night and Good Luck's main selling point is Murrow's courage in standing up to McCarthy. A civics lesson about dissent that induces nostalgia for days when men were men and reporters took a stand. Yet what the movie's actually about is a reality far darker and far less triumphant. Its real theme is the inherent debasement of mass news in a commercial culture, a process so powerful that even brave individuals can't stop it. You see, news is a product that must be able to pay for itself. In practice, that means getting ratings, finding corporate sponsors, and newsmen becoming purveyors of fluff. And that's precisely what we see happening in the film. Murrow's show, See It Now, has to fret about alienating its sponsor, Alcoa, when it goes after McCarthy. And Murrow himself must placate CBS by hosting the celebrity interview show, Person to Person. All this is clear when Murrow, played by David Strathairn, talks about the upcoming McCarthy broadcast with the CBS apparatchik, well played by Jeff Daniels.
You know how many person-to-persons you're going to have to do to make up for this?
Judy and her daughter Liza next week.
No, no, no. You're interviewing Rin Tin Tin. I'll talk to Mr. Paley. Alcoa won't pay for the ads. And we probably won't either. But nobody will stop you.
How much are the ads?
$3,000.
I'll split it with Fred. He just won't have Christmas presents for his kids this year.
He's a Jew.
Well, don't tell him that. He loves Christmas.
Even when the McCarthy broadcast proves successful, the pressure on Murrow doesn't let up. It doesn't matter that CBS head Bill Paley admires Murrow personally, or that he thinks See It Now is a terrific show, or that he strongly believes McCarthy deserved to be taken down. Paley still pulls See It Now from its regular slot. And why? Its audience is too small, and Paley has a network to run. So he makes a rational business decision. And if he didn't make it, he would be replaced. You see, Murrow may be an icon, but that's how commercial TV works. As it actually happened, Paley didn't shrink See It Now right after the McCarthy broadcast. Clooney has telescoped the time for dramatic effect. No matter. the point still stands. Although Murrow's name was synonymous with serious broadcasting, what CBS really wanted him to do was unserious, to talk to celebrities. You know, ask Liberace about his plans to get married. That's where the ratings were. And Murrow, who enjoyed being a player, may have groused, but he went along with it. That's why, in the end, Good Night and Good Luck may be most valuable as a kind of bleak creation myth. It shows how, from the early days of TV news, a template was put in place that would eventually produce what we have today. Endless coverage of Natalie Holloway, newscasts that cross-promote the latest episode of Desperate Housewives, and Ted Koppel being replaced on Nightline by three hosts, one of whose great credential is that he made a sleazy but highly rated show about Michael Jackson. Like it or not, the age of infotainment was in the cards from the very beginning. And for all his highfalutin speeches about how TV can educate, illuminate, and inspire, Murrow could do nothing to slow it down. Seeing it now, his famed anti-McCarthy broadcast looks less like the flowering of a golden age than a blip on the radar of packaged commercial news. Rather like Shepard Smith and Anderson Cooper unexpectedly exploding with anger during Hurricane Katrina, before returning to their usual sleek selves. Small wonder, then, that Murrow always wished his audience good luck. For even back in the 1950s, Clooney's film suggests, a not-so-good night was already descending on TV news.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and the author of Sore Winners. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
You're driving me crazy. What did I do? What did I do? My tears for you make everything hazy, a cloud in the sky of blue. How true were the friends who were near me to cheer me, believe me, they knew. But you were the one who would hurt me.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Additional support comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. Online at pewtrusts.org. And from Image Entertainment, presenting Bill Maher, I'm Swiss. Political satirist Bill Maher takes a funny look at American life. On DVD, November 1st. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, David Benjamin and Stephen Simon. Their new book, The Next Attack, argues that we're losing the war on terror and the war in Iraq is one of the reasons why. And we'll hear from William Crystal, editor of the Weekly Standard. He was a strong advocate of the war. There's a new anthology of articles from his magazine. Join us for the next Fresh Air.